دكتور السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
ورحمة الله وبركاته حبيبي.
You sound a little younger this morning, if I may say.
Don't go there, Maulana, please.
Okay, okay, okay. When the elders speak, we must listen. The story that caught your eye this week.
Well, as always, we look at the bizarre, the unusual, and the plain loony stories that made it into the news. Crazy and unusual stuff. Well, dear brothers, I hope that no ladies are listening right now, because I came across some very troublesome news in yesterday morning's newspaper. In fact, I had to hide the newspaper from my Ruksana. An article in the paper had this headline: Brains of Women More Active Than Men.
Mm.
Did you hear that? Female brains are more active compared to that of men. That, dear brothers, is so ridiculous. It must be fake news. But, well, it was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease in the United States. Apparently, there is an increase in blood flow for women to something called the limbic region of the brain. Here's what the article says. The brains of women are significantly more active in many more areas of the brain than men, especially in the prefrontal cortex involved with focus and impulse control, and the limbic or emotional areas of the brain involved with mood and anxiety, and that's been found by new research. The study findings of increased prefrontal cortex blood flow in women compared to men may explain why women tend to exhibit greater strength in the areas of empathy, intuition, collaboration, self-control, and appropriate concern. And the part of this article that I don't like is right at the end. It says, men have higher rates of attention deficit, stroke, hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and conduct-related problems. I'm not sure what all that means, dear brothers, but it certainly sounds like an attack on all of us. Better blood flow throughout a woman's brains? What nonsense, What nonsense? Just because she can put ghee on the tawa and turn the roti on it with one hand while stirring the onions in the other pot with the other hand, while telling the grandchild a story to encourage it to finish the cereal. So what? What makes her so special, eh? They say we are highly attention deficit. We can't concentrate. Can't focus. Really, eh? Have they ever seen any of us watching Man United against Liverpool, eh? Attention deficit, for my foot, attention deficit. Whoever did that study was clearly BDD, that is Badam Dude Deprived, and I've done lots of research on that. And now to another story that is currently making the headlines. Once upon a time, in the year 2003, in the month of March, an intrepid band of civil rights activists left the shores of their homeland to travel across a continent to a strange land where war was imminent. These brave souls were ready to put their lives on the line to uphold and defend the human rights of another nation under threat of destruction. They were committed to pay the ultimate price to uphold international law. They were not just going to speak truth to power. No. They were going to stand up to a superpower and say, thou shalt not commit evil actions. And so it came to pass, dear listeners, that the group of fearless fighters for justice and freedom left these shores, leaving behind their loved ones who feared that they would never see them again. A final goodbye. Leading the group on this dangerous mission into the valley of death was a person who was well known to embark on ventures that were considered to be beyond craziness and foolhardy. His name, Abu Bakr. No, not Baghdadi. Even worse, it was Abu Bakr Ahmad Muhammad Dauji Ganji Patel of Gala District 14, Surat. Yes, a South African A South African leading a band of 33 South Africans, the Human Shields, headed for Iraq, to place themselves at water filtration plants, electricity power stations, dams, oil refineries, all the structures that, if bombed by the evil West, would have a devastating impact on the civilians of Iraq. The Geneva Convention makes it a war crime to bomb such structures. The Human Shields were fearful, but at the same time very excited, nervous but motivated to do the right thing, to confront evil head on. And amongst these 33 brave men and women was a 19-year-old young black man, a black man. Here is a media report at that time. While others his age are more concerned with parties than politics, he volunteered to go into a war zone as a human shield. He said, "My objective was to show solidarity with the people of Iraq, especially the youth. Our aim was to discourage attacks on civilian infrastructure, such as schools, hospitals, and power stations." He said, "This goes back to humanity. If this could happen in Iraq, it could happen to Africa. We were prepared to die for a good cause." Wow, dear listeners, what an amazing young man. He had his whole life before him, but he was prepared to sacrifice it for truth and justice. Ooh, brings tears to my eyes. So much maturity in a 19-year-old. Incredible, eh? What a guy. What is his name? Let me give you a clue. At 25, he became the youngest MP in the South African Parliament. So amazing, eh? You still don't know? His name, dear listeners, is Duduzi Manana, the Deputy Minister of Education, who won't be Deputy Minister of Education for too long. His sell-by date has just arrived. Manana went bananas at a nightclub, viciously beating a woman for arguing with him and calling him gay. Here is a report from the South African government news agency of a few years ago. It says here, he always gets a buzz out of question time in parliament without the slightest ruffle of temper. Even when he addresses his opponents, he's always very calm, something one finds quite fascinating given his youthful age. Manana comes across as the master of his thought process. No temper, calm, master of his thought process. Good heavens. Then who was that guy captured on video beating that woman, eh? That was absolutely terrible. But his timing couldn't have been worse, eh? In Women's Month, the main topic is violence against women. Well, he's out on 5,000 and bail, and with the public outcry, it looks like his destination is the tronk. That is a bigger nightmare than when bombs were falling all around him in Iraq. But wait, let's not be too hasty, dear brothers and sisters. Let's not be too hasty, okay? On his return from Iraq, it was reported in the media that he said that he would see a clinical psychologist to help him deal with what he had seen. Hey, man, there you are. What a first-class defense. Your Honor, I was suffering from shell shock when I returned from Iraq. My nerves were shot. I'm a total wreck because America attacked Iraq. Your Honor, I respectfully suggest that instead of me, you should actually put George Bush on trial. What do you say, hey, Boot? Well, I'm not sure if it'll work, but it's worth a shot, eh? What do you think? And talking about thinking, I thought about something else. I pondered what Manana had done. Perhaps, dear listeners, you may have an answer to this. When a black person attacks another black person, it is viewed plainly just as violence. One person made another angry, and so it was a clash. Violence. If a white person is enraged, angered by another white person and hits him, that, of course, again, is just viewed as violence. But why is it that if a white person is angered by a black person and hits him, then that is almost always described as a racist attack. Why can't it be just seen as, in the other two instances, as just a violent encounter? And one more, if a black person attacks a white person, is that a racist attack? Very interesting equations, eh? Anyway, last word about Nduduzi Manana. He could have lost his life in a split second in Iraq, but now, in 5 minutes of madness, he has destroyed his life. He should have been a human shield to protect women from violence, but now Nduduzi Manana is just a plain Nduduzi Mampara. What a shame.
Talking about Mamparas, we hear that Netanyahu is in some trouble.
You know, Malana, I said it before and I will say it again. There are two things that I really, really, really admire about Israel. Firstly, its unflinching, uncompromising application of the law regarding criminal activity in respect of its people. Secondly, its abiding sense of vision and strategic planning. Are you now convinced, dear listeners, that I'm smoking something or completely lost my marbles? Let me explain. When it comes to going after crooks, Israel acts without fear or favor. You can be a big shot businessman or a powerful politician right at the top. If you commit a crime, it's brown bread and black tea for you. So, let's look at the top boys in politics. How much higher can you go than the president of Israel? Well, on the 1st of August 2000, Moshe Katsav was sworn in by the Knesset, the parliament, as president of Israel for a 7-year term. By the way, a bit of interesting news, he was born in Iran, and his name when he was in Iran was Musa Katsav. Hey, Musa Katsav. And he was a baby when his family moved to Israel in 1951. Of course, he is Jewish, and actually there are quite a lot of Jews still living in Iran, and there are officially places specially reserved for them in the Iranian parliament. Anyway, I digress. Musabai had a weakness that got that got him into serious trouble. Well, to explain it in the Durban lingo, Durban language, he liked to tinta the aunties. President Moshe Katsav couldn't keep his hands to himself. And here is what Wikipedia says. In July 2006, Katsav complained to the Attorney General of Israel, Menachem Mazuz, that he was being blackmailed by a female employee. The investigation quickly turned against Katsav as the employee referred to as, her name is Oli Revivo. She alleged sexual offenses that he committed. Revivo, who worked with Katsav when he was Minister of Tourism, claimed that Katsav raped her twice and sexually harassed her in various other ways. Katsav was accused of raping and sexually harassing up to 10 women. Well, it was a big story in Israel, as you can imagine. A president facing serious charges and the wheels of justice proceeding in a very determined manner. So, all this is so similar to South Africa, ne, Molana? Imagine if our dear president faced a serious charge, or maybe 10 charges, or shall we say 783 charges. I am sure that our prosecuting authority won't hesitate to take him to court immediately. Immediately. Let's look at another top politician, Ehud Olmert. He was the Prime Minister of Israel. And on the 30th of December 2010, On 30th December 2010, three judges unanimously found Katsav guilty of rape, sexual harassment, committing an indecent act while using force, harassing a witness, and obstruction of justice. And Katsav faced a maximum jail of 49 years. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that it was a sad day for Israel, but that the verdict shows that in Israel, all are equal before the law. Then on 22nd March 2011, Moshe Katsav was sentenced to 7 years in prison and 2 years probation for rape, indecent acts, sexual harassment, and obstruction of justice, becoming the first former president of Israel to be sentenced to prison. Katsav arrived at Matiyahu prison in Ramla at 10 a.m. on 7 December 2011 to begin serving his sentence. On December 21, 2016, Ketsa was released from prison after the state attorney decided not to appeal the parole board's decision for early release. And then I was telling you about Ehud Olmert, who was the Prime Minister of Israel. Ehud Olmert was convicted and imprisoned for municipal corruption, including taking bribes worth $450,000 connected to various real estate deals. In May 2014, he was sentenced to 6 years imprisonment for bribery. In late December 2015, Israel's High Court reduced his sentence to 18 months, extended to 27 months for obstruction of justice. And then in mid-February 2016, he began serving his sentence. And on July 2nd, he was released after serving one-third of it, provided he undergoes rehabilitation and performs community service. So, dear listeners, who else would you like to see in throng in Israel? Which Israeli politician? I beg your pardon? I can't hear you. Yes, of course. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister. Of course you would like to see him in throng. But what is the chance of that happening? And the answer is a very good chance. A very good chance indeed, Habibi. Here is the report. He's been investigated for over a year for alleged bribery, fraud and breach of trust, including for accepting about $1.1 million from accused French fraudster Arnaud Mimran in 2009. Well, and the bad news for Netanyahu is that his chief of staff and very close advisor for many years, himself involved in corruption, has turned state witness against Netanyahu. He knows what Netanyahu has been up to and is ready to open the can of worms. Netanyahu could face two charges. The first one, that he illegally received very lavish gifts from wealthy supporters, and that amounts to bribery. And the second charge, he was caught red-handed in a taped recording where he told a top newspaper in Israel, which is known as Yadiot Aronot, if they gave him favorable coverage, he would pass legislation to block the free distribution of a rival daily newspaper called the Israel Hayom. That is really a big nail in his coffin. It's called quid pro quo, meaning give something for something. You scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. Very nice expression, that quid pro quo. Dear ladies, when the bully is having lunch today, just tell him, I'll cook your favorite mutias for supper if you take me tomorrow to the dressmaker to make my Eid outfit. What do you think of that quid pro quo, darling? So, dear listeners, well, that's guaranteed to get him choked on the dal and chowl. So, dear listeners, Netanyahu could end up in jail, again demonstrating that no one is above the law. Justice for Palestinians? Equality before the law for Palestinians? Now, that is a different story completely. Okay, now to the second point that I made earlier. The incredible foresight, advanced strategic planning, looking at the future, having a vision, and then systematically working towards making it happen. That is what Israel is all about. Or should I say, that is what those who planned for the creation of Israel, the Zionists, carefully thought out 50 years before Israel was actually came into existence. They have an objective in mind, and they work in a determined manner to achieve it. Britain was the only superpower, so-called superpower, in the early 20th century. So they got the top boys to get close to the top boys in the British government, and the British government gave them a letter, the Balfour Declaration, allowing them to have a homeland in Palestine. That was during the First World War, when Palestine, as part of the Ottoman Empire, was defeated. Then, after the Second World War, the U.S. was the major power, the major superpower. So, the Zionists got close to the U.S. President Harry Truman, who gave them the full support at the United Nations for their state. And so it continued, and it is known that you can't just rely on any one president. I'm sure the listeners know all of this. presidents just come and go, and they could change their minds about supporting Israel. So to make sure that any president doesn't change his mind, they put a very powerful organization in place, APAC, American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. I think it's got an annual budget of about $20 million. Lots of congressmen get nice donations from Zionist groups in America, and they are happy to serve Israel. Latest law that is being considered by American Congress is one which targets BBS. You know, you can face a fat fine and a long term in prison if you call for a boycott of Israel in the United States. Amazing, eh? The United States of America, a land of freedom of speech. You can say anything, anything at all. You are free to insult Islam and Muslims as much as you want. But hey, don't say that Israel must be boycotted. That is a very, very serious crime indeed. And as I said last week, while we are busy with the ulema wars, while Saudi Arabia is busy throttling Qatar and bombing Yemen at the same time, and Muslims are killing Muslims all over the Middle East, Israel is not sleeping. It is steadily making friends and influencing people right here on our doorstep. Yes, one after another, the countries of Africa are being charmed by Israel. Charmed by Israel. And Prime Minister Netanyahu, who was part of the 51st summit of the Economic Community of West African States, that is ECOWAS, which was held in Liberia on the 4th of June, said, Israel is coming back to Africa, and Africa back to Israel. Africa is on the rise, and we believe in Africa. Wow. Did you get it? Loud and clear. Nothing hidden. Nothing hidden at all. What a statement. And there is a clear purpose why Israel is working hard to make friends with African countries. Here is what Newsweek reported. Prior to his trip to Liberia, Netanyahu said the purpose of the trip was to win over African support for Israel, which would come in handy during UN Security Council votes on Israeli settlements and peace negotiations with the Palestinians. He said, the purpose of this trip is to dissolve this majority, this giant block of 54 African countries that is the basis of the automatic majority against Israel in the UN and international bodies. Wow, isn't that fantastic? As I said, loud and clear, nothing hidden. Israel wants the African countries to help it at the United Nations, give it full support against hostile forces. And you know what? It looks like Europe is slowly turning against Israel. And this was reported in the Jerusalem Post. Most European governments can hardly be viewed as true friends of Israel, and the massive influx of Muslim immigrants from the Middle East, combined with the rise of both the far left and the far right, indicate that Europe-Israel relationship will continue to deteriorate. Continue to deteriorate. So Israel needs new friends. In October, in October 25 to 30 African heads of state are expected to attend a meeting which is called the Israel Africa Summit in Togo. Morocco called on these African leaders not to go, and they told Morocco to buzz off. So, dear listeners, what did I tell you? When it comes to forward planning, Israel is a great example. No wonder it has survived for so long. It always looks at the big picture. Meanwhile, the ulema wars continue.
Light at the end of the tunnel.
You know, Maulana, social media is terrible. Eh? Terrible. Recycled jokes just keep coming up over and over and over again. Somebody stick something on, change the names here and there, make the Pakistani into a Mehman or something like that, and the thing is, they put Danya on the old jokes that got hair growing on it. And let me just warn you, dear listeners, if anyone sends me the joke about two Jews on a plane, I will send Duduzi over to sort you out, eh? Okay? In yesterday's paper, I came across a very witty statement. It says, it was on my fifth birthday that Papa put his hand on my shoulder and said, remember, my son, if you ever need a helping hand, you'll find one at the end of your arm. Two boys were arguing in the madrasa classroom. Just then the Maulana came in and he said to them, "What are you making noise here? Hey, what are you all arguing about?" And the boys answered, "Maulana, we found the 50 rand note and we decided to give it to whoever tells the biggest lie." The Maulana said, Chi, "Don't you know that is haram? When I was your age, I never spoke a lie." The boys gave the 50 rand to the Maulana. Okay, one last one. You know, the teacher in Isipingo High School, he was lecturing the kids on map reading. And after explaining latitude and longitude and degrees and minutes, the teacher asked, "Suppose I ask you to meet me for lunch at 23 degrees, 4 minutes north latitude and 45 degrees, 15 minutes east latitude." After a very long silence in the class, a voice from the back of the class said, "Teacher, I think you will be eating alone."
Uncle Abi, as always, jazakumullah for your time. We'll talk again next week, inshallah.
Inshallah, always a pleasure. Habibi, Habibi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.